All right. Luke chapter 22, we're picking up in verse 63. We left off in the 62nd verse. Now we're going to finish up the Gospel of Luke here in the next couple of weeks and just praying about where we go from here. And I'm sure the Lord will make that clear as we get closer. I'm not sure yet, though. So we pick up. Jesus has been arrested now. And as we pick up the account, we read, "Now the men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him. And having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, 'Prophesy, who is the one who struck you?' And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him." Of course, as we read through this account here, maybe for some of you who are familiar with Isaiah's description of the suffering servant, you'll see little glimpses of that come through here. But just the brutalizing that Jesus experienced for our sakes, it's really humbling when you think of all that he went through. "And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both the chief priest and the scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, 'If you are the Christ, tell us.' But he said to them, 'If I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." Now, of course, we have four accounts given to us. Each of the Gospels give us an account of the events that we're reading about here. But each of the Gospel writers presents them just a little bit differently. And Luke, he's giving us some detail, but there are several things that Luke is leaving out. He's getting just really to kind of the main point that he wants to keep emphasizing is the fact that Jesus is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God. So he's zeroing in on the things that Jesus said that relate to that. So they're asking him this question: "Are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah?" Now, Jesus, of course, had told them previously that he was. And he had told them on various occasions that he was the Messiah. But, of course, they didn't believe him. So they're pressing once again. And then they all said, "Are you the Son of God?" So he said to them, "You rightly say that I am." And they said, "What further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." So this was it as far as they were concerned. Now, all of this was happening amongst the Jewish elders. He's not yet been delivered over to Pilate. That comes next. But all of this is happening with first in the house of Annas, then in the palace of Caiaphas, and all of those that Jesus is standing before and being abused by, all of them are Jews. And what they're condemning him of now is blasphemy, because they considered his claim to be the Son of God a blasphemous claim. You see, amongst the Jews, when Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, they understood him to be claiming equality with God. Somehow in our thinking, when we hear the words "the Son of God," we somehow think of Jesus sometimes as less than God, or we think that the Son of God is a term that, you know, sort of lessens his position. But that was not the understanding of the people at the time. You see, when he claimed to be the Son of God, what he was essentially claiming is to share in the divine nature, which of course would make him God. And I bring that out because, you know, people today who are opposed to the biblical doctrine of the deity of Christ, they will often say, oh, well, you know, doesn't say Jesus is God in the Bible. It says he's the Son of God. Well, it does say he's God in several places. But even if it didn't say that, when it says he's the Son of God, the implication there is that he shares in the nature of God. And the Jews completely understood that. That's why they asked him this question. Are you the Son of God? Are you equal with God? Do you share in the divine nature? That's what they were really asking him. And his answer was, you rightly say that I am. So this is what brought the condemnation as far as they were concerned. So then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. It's an interesting thing here because if there was one man that the Jews hated, it was Pilate. They absolutely hated him. There was no love lost between Pilate and the Jews either. They were very much adversarial in their relations to one another. When Pilate first was appointed as the governor over the area, he came in and he completely disregarded the history of the people. He completely disregarded their religion and their culture. And he severely offended them. So they got off on the wrong foot in their relationship. And things just went from bad to worse as time went on. So much so that at one point, the Jewish leadership had sent word to Caesar himself to complain about Pilate. And Pilate had been to some degree reprimanded by Caesar. So, but you see, they can't put Jesus to death because they don't have the authority to do it. The Roman authority has to pass the death sentence. So even though they loathed Pilate, they went to him and they took Jesus before him. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Now, of course, these were trumped up charges. They were not true. But notice how deceptive they are here. What were they condemning Jesus over? They were condemning him over blasphemy because he claimed to be the Son of God. They don't go to Pilate and said, "This man claimed to be the Son of God," because they know that Pilate wouldn't have had anything to do with those kinds of issues. But instead, they try to put him forth as one who is subverting the nation. They try to put him forth as a rebel against the Roman authority. So we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar. So this was just a blatant lie because, of course, Jesus never did forbid them to pay taxes to Caesar. He said, as you remember, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. But then he says, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. So they're accusing Jesus of insurrection against Caesar. He's saying that he's the king. Now, think about this. These are Jews. This is the high priest and all of the elders of Israel. And this is their brother. This is their fellow Jew. And yet they're turning him over to Rome and they're seeking to get a sentence of death passed upon him by Rome. And the only way to do that is to lie and to try to present him in a way that would cause Rome to maybe to some degree be threatened by him and then have to deal with him. But Pilate, interestingly, as you go through, and like I said, the other Gospels kind of fill in some of the blanks there, but as you go through, you see that Pilate, he's a man who's torn in this whole matter. I think, first of all, he hated these guys so bad, he didn't want to do anything that they requested. But then as you read through, it does seem that there was something about Jesus that there was something there that Pilate was at least curious about. And it's interesting that Jesus spoke with Pilate. We'll see in a moment that there was another leader that he didn't even speak to. But Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered him and said, "It is as you say." So Pilate said to the chief priest and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." But they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." And when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. You see here, Pilate was in a quandary. He really did not want to pass the sentence they were requesting on Jesus. He's already declared him, "I find no fault in this man." But now he sees that he can maybe just get rid of the problem. When he finds out that Jesus originally hailed from Galilee, he sends him to Herod. And the interesting thing here is that what Pilate is actually doing is he's relinquishing his power and pretty much turning it over to Herod, which was an unusual thing, but it just kind of shows how desperate he was to not have to make the final decision in this particular case. Now, when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing. Jesus did not speak a word to Herod. Interesting. He spoke several things to Pilate, but he said nothing to Herod. Now remember, this is the Herod who had earlier listened and gladly listened to the preaching of John. But of course, we know how he was influenced by his wife and his stepdaughter, and how eventually he passed the sentence on John to be beheaded. But, you know, here's a man who at one time, you know, seemed to have a bit of a sensitivity or a bit of a conscience. But now, apparently, his conscience is so seared from all of that sin that Jesus doesn't bother to even speak a single word to him. And the chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with one another. Interesting. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and rulers of the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." So here, both Herod and Pilate have declared the man is innocent. This man is not guilty of the things that you're accusing him of. Now, Of course, at this moment, they should have released Jesus. But you see here with Pilate especially, you see where instead of doing what was right, he rather chose what to do was politically, he chose what was politically expedient. He was a typical politician. He doesn't do the right thing, even though he knows that Jesus is innocent. But he also knows that if he doesn't give in to the wishes of this group of men, that he is at risk of losing his governorship. Because they've already gone to the emperor once. And he knows that they will do that again. And they've already insinuated that Jesus is putting himself up as an opposing king to Caesar. So if Pilate were to release him, then you would have to question Pilate's loyalty to Caesar. Of course, these rulers in these days, they were all a bunch of, you know, they were a bunch of paranoid power mongers. And all they really wanted to do was make sure they could stay in power. They just wanted to maintain their position. And so Pilate knows what's right, but sadly, he doesn't do what's right. Verse 17, "For it was necessary for him to release one of them at the feast. And they all cried out at once, saying, 'Away with this man and release to us Barabbas.'" Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. So Pilate says regarding Jesus, "I'm going to chastise him and release him," because there was a custom that at the feast, the Passover time, they would, the Romans, in trying to ingratiate themselves a little bit to the people, they would release a prisoner. And so he's saying that this works perfect. I'll just chastise him and release him. Like, that's part of the custom. But they cry out and say, "No, we don't want him. We want instead Barabbas, this man who was a rebel." "Now Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them, but they shouted, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.' Then he said to them the third time, 'Why? What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go.' But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified, and the voices of these men and of the chief priest prevailed." Amazing. The chief priest. They were the ones who led in this whole effort to get Jesus executed. Isn't it amazing, though, how you put the picture together from the prophecies and all, you know, the Old Testament? And remember, it was the high priest. What did the high priest do? It was the high priest who offered the sacrifice for sin. And now here it's the high priest. Of course, they're doing it in a completely different way, but they're actually involved in what will ultimately be, of course, the death of Christ, but what will finally be the sacrifice for the sin of the world. The high priest is involved in this whole process. Remember, John tells us at one point, Caiaphas stands up and he says, "Oh, you don't know anything. You know, if we don't deal with this man, the whole world's going to come after him. And the Romans are going to come and they're going to take away our position." And basically what Caiaphas said is, it's better that one man die for the nation than the whole nation perish. That's what he said. We need to kill Jesus, because if we don't kill Jesus, the Romans are going to come and they're going to take away our position and the whole nation will perish. Better that one man die than the whole nation perish. John says this he spoke prophetically, being the high priest. He didn't know what he was saying. He was saying we need to kill Jesus to preserve ourselves. But because he was the high priest, There was actually a supernatural thing that was happening where he was speaking prophetically that one man would die for the sins of the nation so the nation would not perish. And so we see that whole thing being played out here. You know, something that really strikes me, and this is, I think, so powerful, especially when we consider Jewish people today and we consider Israel today. You know, there have been several who have come along in history and have put forth the claim to be the Messiah. And there have been, on occasions, numbers of Jews that have followed along with some of those people. In the first century, there was a man named Bar Kokhba that rose up. And his name means son of the star. And he took that name believing that he was a fulfillment of the prophecy of Balaam, that a star would rise up out of Jacob. And so multitudes of Jews followed him, believing he was the Messiah. And others have come along in history, and there have been those that have followed them, even as recently as just 15 or 20 years ago. There was an Orthodox rabbi that many thought was the Messiah. But you know, the thing that I find so interesting is there's only one man in all of history who stood in the presence of the Sanhedrin before the high priest and claimed to be the Messiah of Israel. And of course, that was Jesus. No one else ever did anything like that. And I think that that's so astounding to consider that in the very presence of that group and right before the high priest, he made that claim. Some have gone so far as to say, oh, Jesus never really claimed to be the Messiah. Oh, yes, he did. And he claimed it right in the presence of the high priest. And so we see here, it's the high priest, it's the chief priest and all of the family of the priest. They're the ones who are leading this whole thing against Jesus. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. This man Barabbas really, although of course an actual historical character, becomes a picture. And this transaction becomes a picture of salvation. Here is Barabbas, who is guilty of rebellion and murder. And here's Jesus, who is innocent of any crimes whatsoever. Barabbas is set free, and Jesus dies in his place. It's interesting. His name means son of the father. I don't know that that necessarily has any significance, but that is what his name means. But here in just this incident, again, we get a little picture of the gospel. This is the gospel. An innocent victim dying in the place of the guilty. Barabbas should have died. He should have been the one to be executed, but he was set free and Jesus died in his place. And so just in this incident alone, you have just a little picture of what the gospel is. The innocent victim dying in the place of the guilty. Now as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country, and on him they laid the cross that he might bear it after Jesus. And a great multitude of the people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, wombs that never bore, and breasts which never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry?" And so here Jesus is prophesying really of the destruction that will come to Jerusalem in the days ahead. And there were also two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to the place called Calvary, Calvary meaning the skull, when they had come to the place called the skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." And they divided his garments and cast lots. Remember, it was Jesus who had taught that you were to love your enemies. You were to bless those who cursed you. And you were to pray for those who despitefully used you and persecuted you. Jesus taught that and he lived it. Jesus was not one who preached one thing and lived another. He lived what he preached. People today will say, "Oh, I don't want to have anything to do with the church. I don't want to hear about Christianity. I've met so many Christians who are hypocrites," they'll say. And maybe so. But Jesus was no hypocrite. And on the final day, no one's going to be judged by what a Christian did or didn't do. Everyone's going to stand before God and be measured by Jesus. He's the measuring stick. And although every Christian might be a hypocrite to some degree or another, Jesus was no hypocrite. And at the end, God didn't really say, "Look at all these other Christians." He really said, "Look at my son." He's called us to look at his son. So all of these, you know, excuses that people put forth because of the hypocrisy that they've seen in the lives of those who claim to be the followers of Jesus, none of that is going to stand on the judgment day, because God told us to look to Christ himself, and Jesus was no hypocrite. "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." Amazing to think that Jesus prayed this prayer while they were in the process of executing him. "Father, forgive them." This is something that's so, I mean, it's almost impossible for us to grasp that, isn't it? I know for myself, I can think about forgiving people, and, you know, theoretically it all sounds good, and I know it's right. That's what God would have me to do. But, you know, when it comes down to actually doing it, sometimes it's a whole different thing, isn't it? I'd like to do it. I know it's the right thing to do. I know it's a thing God wants me to do, but this is hard. And you know, sometimes we find ourselves, I think, at least I know I do, you know, the people that are easiest to forgive, I realize, you know, they haven't offended me that much. That's why they're easy to forgive. It's the ones that have really offended me. Those are the ones that's really challenging. Well, you can't get much more offensive than this. These men are putting him to death. They've betrayed him. They've lied about him. They've slandered him. They have beaten him and mocked him and ridiculed him. And now they are having him executed. This slow process of dying by crucifixion. And Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. That is, it's just amazing. But you know, through the Spirit of God, God is able to give us the ability to do things that we could not naturally do. And there are those times when you'll read a story or you'll meet a person or you'll just find out somehow about one of those kinds of situations where some horrific thing has been done to somebody else, but through the power of the Spirit of God, that person has been able to forgive the perpetrator. And in many cases, this has been a powerful tool that has actually turned those who had committed the crimes, it's actually turned them toward the Lord when they've received that kind of mercy from a person who they know very well they don't deserve any of that mercy from. Somebody asked me recently, well, was this prayer answered? Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Was this prayer answered? It was answered. Of course, because the possibility of forgiveness was opened up to everyone, even the very men that committed this crime against Jesus. But we also know that even right there on the spot, hearts were touched. We'll read about the centurion in a moment who is the one in charge of the crucifixion. And at the end of everything, he says, truly, this man was the Son of God. So you can see right there where his heart was evidently touched. And we don't know who else was in the crowd touched, but we know that he was. And so the people stood looking on, but even the rulers with them sneered, saying, he saved others. Let him save himself if he is the Christ, the chosen of God. You know, I think, you know, we can read this, but I don't even think we can begin to comprehend this. This is the most vicious, heartless, ruthless, hateful kind of thing imaginable that's going on. Can you imagine the demonic frenzy that is transpiring at this moment as well? I mean, this whole thing, as we read it, the crowd shouting, crucify him, the chief priest leading it, you've got to know that there was like a satanic frenzy. Satan, of course, was whipping all of this up. And now it says they sneered at him, just that hatred. And it's hard to imagine, unless you've ever been subjected to that kind of animosity, that kind of hatred, it's hard to even conceive of this. I've never been subjected to this kind of thing before. I've read about it. I've heard stories of it, but I've never been subjected to it. But to just read it, sometimes I think we miss the drama of what's really happening here. This would have been probably one of the most horrifying environments or atmospheres or, you know, moments in history, one of the most horrifying times ever, to just see all of this absolute hatred being spewed, as it says, they sneered at him and they mocked him. The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine and saying, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. Now, of course, the Romans would have had a great time with this because the Jews were under their heel already. And so here's the king of the Jews. They would have had a great time mocking him here. And an inscription also was written over him in letters of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. This is the King of the Jews. Isn't it interesting that Pilate was the one who actually had this written? And he had it written in these three languages, which would have been basically the languages of anybody and everybody that would have been in Jerusalem. And again, as although Pilate wasn't in any way innocent, or he obviously had some sort of sympathy toward Jesus, but we don't know what his motives were. But I think in his desire to inflict the Jewish leaders, you remember, he has them put the placard there, and they say, "Oh no, don't write, he's the king of the Jews. Write, he said he's the king of the Jews." And Pilate refused to change it. He said, "What I have written, I have written." He left it. This is the king of the Jews. We know actually from the other gospels, it was a little more full than Luke tells us here. This is Jesus of Nazareth, the king of the Jews. Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." Notice this cry, "Save yourself, save yourself, save yourself." Oh, he saved others, but look, he can't save himself. That's where you see the real demonic side of what's going on here. Because remember when Satan tempted Jesus? What was Satan trying to accomplish in those temptations that we read about? If you're the Son of God, take these stones and turn them into bread. If you're the Son of God, jump off the pinnacle of the temple. You know, God will protect you. If you're... I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world if you bow down and worship me and so forth. Satan, in all of that temptation, he was trying to get Jesus to circumvent the cross, to not go in the way of the cross. And now here he is hanging on the cross. And what are these voices saying? Come down from the cross. It's not too late. You don't have to go through with this. Save yourself. Remember, that's what Peter said to Jesus. And that's when Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan." Jesus told what was going to happen. Peter said, "Never, Lord, just get that out of your mind. That's never going to happen to you. You're not going to die. You're not going to be crucified. You're not." Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." And so here in this continual "save yourself," we hear the echoes of the devil still trying to prevent the death of Christ for the sin of the world. And so, "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." But the other, answering, rebuked him, saying, "Do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." So here's two criminals. And as the one says, we are justly condemned for our deeds. We're not told what they did. But he says, we're justly condemned. But this man has done nothing wrong. Now, the amazing thing is, from, I think it's Mark's gospel, we learn that in the earlier part of this whole scene, both of these men were pronouncing those blasphemous things upon Jesus. Both of them were doing it. But evidently, as this whole thing continued on, one of them stopped mocking and started watching and listening, evidently, and maybe even remembering things that he had learned as a child in the scriptures. And suddenly he's got a whole different perspective on this. He says, this man has done nothing wrong. And then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Amazing. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now, here's the question that is posed, but there is no way to really answer it. But it's something that we see. How is it that two people can be equally close to salvation, have the same opportunities for salvation, and one be saved and the other not be saved? This is just one of the mysteries that we'll never solve this side of eternity. You know, you see people that have been given every opportunity, and people that have just, you know, they've heard the gospel over and over clearly, and they've been in their circumstances of life have lent to a receiving of salvation, but they never do it. They never make the connection with the Lord. And then you find a person who is equally as bad, equally as messed up, equally as lost, and they hear it and they respond and they're saved. And it's just one of those mysterious things that we really can't finally know in the end. Why some people are saved and some aren't, is there's a mystery to it to some extent. Of course, we can say, oh, well, it's because some believed and some didn't believe. That's true, but why didn't they believe? That's the thing that we just it doesn't compute. Doesn't make any sense. But we see it, and we see it very clearly right here in this situation. But it's amazing what Jesus says in response to the man. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. I don't think he was expecting that. But I'm certain he was sure glad to hear it. You know, he's just hoping, Lord, could you think about me sometime, you know? Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. You know, in Hebrews it says that Jesus endured the cross, suffering the shame. And it says he did so for the joy that was set before him. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, suffering the shame. And what is that joy? It's the joy of bringing men and women to salvation. And here in the midst of this deep agony that Jesus is experiencing, you know that God allows him just a little taste, just a little foretaste of what is yet to come. Isn't that amazing that when Jesus died, it was for the joy of saving us that he endured the cross, although he despised the shame. And literally, when he died, you were on his mind. I was on his mind. He was thinking of us. We would be the joy that led him to do what he did. And here God gives him just a little taste, the first fruit of his work. And now it was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. So from noon till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was dark. The sun was darkened. Just exactly how the sun was darkened, we don't know. But, well, you could be sure that this just must have been some kind of scene there at the cross when it went dark in the middle of the day for 3 hours, and the veil of the temple was torn in two. That veil that hung, that separated the holy place from the sanctuary, that veil that symbolized the separation between God and man, the veil that spoke of God's holiness on the one side and man's sinfulness on the other side. And in the temple, this veil was 18 inches thick. And it went from the top all the way down. This was just a massive piece of cloth. And it was torn from the top to the bottom. A new Christian who's just devouring the scriptures came to me last week, and she said this, and I never heard anything like this before, but it was so interesting. She said, do you think that Jesus tore that? when he died? Do you think that he actually tore it himself? I said, I don't know. He might have just stepped on it on his way up. He might have. I don't know. It was torn from the top to the bottom. Notice from the top to the bottom it was torn. Doesn't tell us that here, but it tells us in another gospel. It was torn in two. And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. So when the centurion saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, certainly this was a righteous man. Or as the other gospel accounts tell us, certainly this was the Son of God. This is the man probably said, truly this is a righteous man, or the word could be translated innocent. But in saying that, what he's essentially saying is everything he said about himself is true. Truly, this was the Son of God. The first fruit, again, we see here of those prayers, of that prayer. And the whole crowd who came together to that site, seeing what had been done, beat their breast and returned. But all his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things. Now behold, there was a man named Joseph, a council member, a good and a just man. He had not consented to their decision. Indeed, he was from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who himself was also waiting for the kingdom of God. So we know that Joseph was part of that group. We know that Nicodemus was part of that group as well. Some say that Saul of Tarsus was part of this group. We don't know that that's actually a fact, but it might have been. But what we see here is there were men in that group that did not consent. They did not agree to the deeds that the priest, the high priest, had done. And here's this man, Joseph. And so he went to Pilate and he asked for the body of Jesus. Then he took it down, wrapped it in linen, and laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of the rock where no one had ever lain before. Remember Isaiah's prophecy where it says that they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death? Jesus died as a criminal. And criminals who were crucified, their bodies were disposed of in the local dump. They were just thrown into the dump and burned. But Isaiah's prophecy was very specific that that would not happen with him. They made his grave with the wicked. That was the intention, but with the rich in his death. And so here, Joseph of Arimathea is the fulfillment of that, just that sort of little side note there in Isaiah 53. He is the rich man who offered up his own tomb for the body of Jesus to lie in. That day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew near. And the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment.